Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Filmcast, a podcast about movies. I'm David Chen, and I scream, you scream, we all scream because this franchise won't die. Joining me today is Devinder Hardawar.
We talk about movies that don't exist. I present to you a movie that shouldn't exist.
And Jeff Cannata.
I'm Jeff Cannata, and I have a question for you. Do you like scary movies? How about franchises that have lost their way? Aren't particularly scary at all.
That's pretty good ghost face, Jeff. That's good. Without a voice changer, by the way, I want people to know.
It's definitely a thing. And not just they hired that same voice actor to do all the movies.
No, it's voice-changing technology. That's what we have.
Why does the ghost face voice seem to get older as time goes on? That's a little strange. Anyway.
Those are making up with the Saw franchise. Yeah.
If they just track the sale of those voice changers, maybe we could stop some murders before they happen.
Maybe they should just outlaw them. Maybe they should stop selling those voice changers. They lead to bad things.
Yeah, that specific voice. I don't know why they keep selling that one.
The masks are still everywhere.
The masks are everywhere too. Yeah.
Right after they get sold, people die. I don't understand it.
Anyway. So those are vague little oblique references to the fact that today on the podcast, we're going to be reviewing Scream 7. Of course, we got some what we've been watching for you before then. And also some of the biggest film news of all time to discuss. So why don't we get right to it, folks?
It's positive, maybe, right?
The last film
it's
news
positive,
of all time.
Right?
Yeah.
Here's the headline from the New York Times. Netflix backs out of bid for Warner Brothers, paving way for an Ellison takeover. Reading here from this article that was published on February 26, Netflix said on Thursday that it had backed away from its deal to acquire Warner Brothers Discovery, a stunning development that paves the way for the storied Hollywood media giant to end up under the control of a rival bidder, the technology heir David Ellison. Netflix said that it would not raise its offer to counter a higher bid made earlier this week by Mr. Ellison's company, Paramount Skydance, adding in a statement that the deal is no longer attractive. According to Netflix co-chief executives, this transaction was always a nice to have at the right price, not a must have at any price, end quote. So
the quote is like, F this noise.
It's the world's biggest nah. They're just like, nah.
Nah. And also they get $3 billion for it, right? So
yeah, like 2.8, but who's counting, Devendra?
Paramount went crazy money, like obscene, like kind of way overpriced. And Netflix was just like, nah.
And also that's all that happened. There was no pressuring by the government. There was no targeting of Susan Rice, who's on Netflix's board. None of that happened too. Like This is a totally normal transaction, folks.
I think it's just funny because there is an episode of Succession, season 4, episode 1, in which an extremely similar dynamic plays out. For those who don't know, a very mild spoilers for that show, but that episode sees Logan Roy bidding against his children for control of the Pierce Media Company. And after an intense bidding war, the children seem to have the upper hand, resulting in Logan coming in and saying, "Congratulations on saying the higher number, you fucking morons." Which really captures, I think, a lot of the wisdom of what is going on here. Now, let me just say a couple things, and then I'd love to hear if you guys have any thoughts on this. In my opinion, there is the kind of surface level extreme badness of one family is going to control CBS News, CNN, the entire Warner Brothers catalog,
HBO.
Paramount Plus, HBO, and also, by the way, Oracle and parts of TikTok.
What about all the other levels of extreme badness?
So that's all the way down. Yeah, yeah. Well, hey, that was just the surface level badness of like, hey, that's probably a bad idea to have consolidation to that degree. But in addition to that, every company that has ever tried to acquire Warner Brothers has done a bad job with it. Warner Brothers has been acquired like, what, 4 or 5 times over the course of the last couple decades? And every single time it's ended in almost total failure. And I do not have confidence that David Ellison is going to be able to manage it any better. They are going to take on an enormous amount of debt to acquire this company, something on the order of $70 to $80 billion, I believe. And that's not a horrible thing. It's fine to use debt to acquire companies. But they will need to service that
debt. Where is that money coming from, Dave?
And in order to, well, it's been backed up by the Ellison family fortune. But
in Saudi Arabia, right?
Yes, partially. And in order to service that debt, they will need to cut costs. They will need to cut costs, and they've like said, hey, we're going to slash, like, there's going to be billions of dollars in savings, which does not sound like somebody who's going to invest more in the movie industry coming up. Like, you can't have like, hey, we need to service this debt, pay off all this money, and also we're putting in more money to invest in the film industry.
Yeah.
So I think it's very possible that from a business perspective, this whole thing falls apart in the next 5, 10, 15 years.
This is a snotty rich kid saying, I want this.
It's right. I don't know, you guys. Yeah. If think of all the cost savings they have when they eliminate truth and fact-checking.
It's true.
It's true.
Oh, it's so much easier that way.
I mean, you're hinting at, like, there's a CNN and a CBS News now. If they're part of the same company, does it make sense to have two news bureaus in Washington? You know, does it make sense to, like, have all these duplicative assets? Tons of people are going to lose their jobs.
Who put these two news agencies together? We only need one. Let's put a failed New York Times journalist, like, in charge of it all. Who's
right? It's gonna be like, instead of investigative journalism, it's gonna be town halls with JD Vance all the time, right?
You know how much cost savings we will get when we just forward on the Truth Social posts? It's so much easier that way. I think you guys are really misunderstanding the financial equation here.
I think you might be right about that, Jeff. I think you might be right about that. But yes, I think putting aside, like, just the propagandistic potential of this organization, I think, like, on a business fundamental levels, this thing is not in a good state. We haven't even talked about you've mentioned the billions of dollars he's paid out to Netflix. He's offered to pay out hundreds of millions of dollars for, like, every quarter the deal doesn't close past a certain time period. Very likely that's going to be invoked.
There's still regulators that has to go through internationally, so we'll see. Right.
We'll see. I mean, there's still some things that may mean this deal might not close, but
yeah.
I will just say, guys, I didn't see this one coming. I thought Netflix kind of was in,
well,
you know,
listen,
pole
in a normal world,
one.
In the normal rules based world where try to acquire something and you go through the business processes and maybe there's a negotiation. Sure, Netflix would have won. This deal is entirely fucked from this administration. And hey, folks, I did some reporting. I'm like, maybe there are some good things a Netflix acquisition could have done for WB or something. There is nothing good here. There is nothing for theatrical, nothing for physical media, nothing for the state of the studio, nothing for news. This is pure doom and gloom. So
it is a horizontal acquisition, right? Like they're basically duplicative duplicative organizations. Mm-hmm. Netflix at least was a tech company, and there's some argument that, oh, hey, we acquire this, like, content catalog and there's some synergies there. This is just, oh, they do the exact same thing, so a bunch of people are going to get laid off. Like, that's basically what this is going to result in. The carnage will be unimaginable, I think, when this goes
through. And, you know, I think it sets a really great precedent, as Devendra was saying, that the first thing you do when you want to make an acquisition is you donate to the political campaign. And the second thing you do if your bid isn't picked is you whine to said political leader.
Well, you also whine to your daddy, who's friends with the political leader. You just whine. It's a lot of rich kid whining over here. So,
But I think, again, it sets a great precedent that if anything that needs to be done in this country, first we grease the wheels of the dear leader, that's what decides what actually happens in the business world.
I do wonder if the fact that David Ellison is very, very cozy with the Trump administration and with other right-wing people of note is going to impact, people's willingness to work for the new singular organization or not. I'm curious if that will make any difference whatsoever.
Four people decide all the jobs, I'm sure we all have lots of choice as to who.
Because that's the thing, it's like, okay, you don't want to shop it to Paramount, Skydance, Warner Brothers, so there's literally like two other options left, right? Like there's there's Universal and then and Disney Fox, right? And then there's like some smaller organizations out there, but like it's really gonna be something that I think kills.
Patreon's for everybody. Everybody gets a Patreon. That's the only way we will survive in the future. Didn't Anderson Cooper announce that he's gonna be leaving 60 Minutes because of like the Barry Weiss bullshit? So
yeah,
you know, maybe there'll be more of that. But he's also, again, rich kid, so you know, so he's gonna be fine.
Yeah. By the way, Sony, the other major studio, by the way, I just wanted to mention, you know, they're supposed to be the big five right now. But the big five is probably going to become the big four very soon. Anyway, go ahead, Jeff, what are you going
to say? I just wanted to thank our patrons one more time for supporting us.
Thank you, patrons.
Yeah.
I'll tell you who David Ellison won't buy. Us.
I mean, we're... Let's be not be hasty, DaVinci.
Let's not
you know,
be hasty. If he's offering Warner Brothers money, which is about $111 billion.
There is a number at which I will change my tune about this administration. Let me tell you.
And it starts with 100, and also there's a billion in the middle of it.
And ends with dollars. Yeah.
Just $100? Wow.
Yes.
CNN is freaking out. People are very worried about not only keeping their jobs, but what the new regime might mean for the kind of news they cover. With this whole acquisition, it means like basically MS Now will be the only cable news channel that isn't right-wing leaning. I think
killed funding for CBP, for Corporation for Public Broadcasting, like public media is going away. The billionaires killed, the Washington Post already. I had a lot of friends there too. So, hey, bleak times, everybody.
Absolutely.
Bleak times.
Absolutely. And that's not even talking about the other bleak stuff that's going on in the world right now. Just in the world of media and Hollywood. It's been
divide.
Fewer sources of trusted news at a time when we're going into war. What could be wrong?
What could go wrong with that? It's going to be great. It's going to be great. But I think the thing is that like I was panicking when Netflix was going to buy Warner Brothers, but then I didn't really like think through exactly how bad this is going to be. You know,
this is what I was telling everybody. It's like, guys, the choice right now is Netflix or Paramount. And Netflix, there are certain positives. Maybe you could see a bit of glimmer of hope in the clouds. There is nothing here. This is a black hole. It's going to be awful.
All right. Well, I think that
what we've been watching.
On to what we've been watching. All right, folks, let's take a break, and we'll be back right after this with more Filmcast.
This episode of the Filmcast is brought to you by BetterHelp. Hey, folks, March includes International Women's Day, which is a moment to celebrate women's strength and progress while also recognizing how much they carry every day. Boy, is that obvious to me as the husband of a woman who does it all. And I'm amazed by it every single day. You know, caring for others, managing unseen responsibilities, their emotional well-being is often overlooked. You know, we want to remind women how much they matter, and that therapy offers a space for them to take care of themselves in a way they deserve. So maybe we could take a moment to celebrate a woman in your life who has had a lasting and memorable impact on you. You know, my mom is in town right now, and certainly I am grateful for the incredible, wonderful childhood that she gave me. And watching my wife work a full-time job and be a mom and manage all of the emotional stress that we have in our household. You know, I have an autistic daughter. Our two kids are, you know, a handful for for anybody. And, you know, just watching my wife handle that with aplomb and also do all the other things that are expected of her, it's hard. And I recognize it. And what better time than now to see that sometimes these needs, when women in particular are worrying about everyone but themselves, these needs, their own needs, get pushed to the wayside. So, you know, oftentimes therapy can be a big help with stuff like that. And BetterHelp has therapists that work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. Of course, BetterHelp does the initial matchmaking work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals without having to worry about figuring out who your therapist is going to be. All you do is fill out a short questionnaire that helps identify your needs and preferences. And then BetterHelp's 12 plus years of experience and industry leading match fulfillment rate means that they, you know, they typically get it right the first time. But if you aren't happy with your match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time from tailored recommendations. And with over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally. And it works with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. Your emotional well-being matters. Find support and feel lighter in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com/Filmcast. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Filmcast, FILMCAST.
As Devendra indicated, we're going to talk about what we've been watching this week. All right, let's get to it, folks. I want to discuss a movie I watched called We Bury the Dead. Have you guys heard about this movie?
Yeah, I want to see this one.
Daisy Ridley zombie survival horror thriller film. And the basic plot is Daisy Ridley's husband was on a work trip in Australia when suddenly the United States unleashed by accident an experimental weapon that devastated much of the island that he was on, off the eastern coast of Tasmania, and also it created brain death in a lot of the victims. Very surreal to watch this movie this week at a time when obviously the United States is part of bombing Iran. And so, and weapons going off and hurting people. Yeah.
Even better, bombing Iran for no apparent reason.
Yeah, this is not a war that has been very well justified by the administration or sold to the American people particularly well. But anyway, in this universe, they are recruiting volunteers to go in and get the dead people out of the homes and like bury the dead people and like take care of their homes and so on. So Daisy Ridley volunteers to be one of the people that goes in to try and find the dead people and like get them out of their homes and restore society back to its place. I would say this movie is okay. Daisy Ridley is very good. I know she's been in a couple things since Rise of Skywalker or the Skywalker franchise, but I haven't really seen that many of them.
Yeah. It could be like the Mark Hamill curse for her. I hope not, because I do like her quite a bit.
Sometimes I Think About Dying. Was that you, Devendra? Did you talk about that?
She had an action one too, right?
Maybe I'm thinking of, yeah, you're right. Chaos Walking is the action one. Sometimes I Think About Dying. I think that was Stephen David Miller writing about it. Anyway, point being, she's been in some things. I really haven't had a chance to watch it, but I'm always curious, you know, people who are part of a franchise that kind of defines how people see them, what do they do with their careers afterwards? And Daisy Ridley has made this kind of interesting zombie horror film called We Bury the Dead. She's great in it. And I think that there are a couple of aspects of this movie that are kind of interesting. I should point out, by the way, that this United States experimental weapon, all this is explained in the first few minutes, created brain death in a lot of the people here, but then some of them have started coming back to life. And it's like, what's going on? What, they're coming back to life? What does that mean? And so they're kind of quote unquote zombies, but who knows what they actually are? And maybe the movie will explain. Anyway, point being, I thought this was a fresh take on a genre that we are all very familiar with, and that it introduces some interesting ideas around zombie horror. And great performances, and the movie is very beautifully shot, very atmospheric, very well made, very competently made. And also, I think it just completely falls apart at the end, in my opinion, and is totally unsatisfying, and I did not like the resolution. And so I'm kind of left with like, oh, I love the first two-thirds, and I thought it was very solid, and then did not like how it ended, and I don't know how to feel about that. So at the end of the day, enough stuff here that makes it worth checking out. Like, again, just like a really... The talent behind the camera, I could feel, and also Daisy Ridley in front of the camera, I could really feel. But not a home run by any stretch of the imagination, and not a movie that I could wholeheartedly recommend, but still noteworthy enough that I want to mention it here on today's podcast. It's called We Bury the Dead. It's available right now on video on demand. All right, Devendra Hardwar, hit us up with something you've been watching this week.
Yeah, what to say? I am, how can I say this? I'm DTW, DTF, St. Louis. Down to watch it. It is
down to watch it.
Down to watch it. This is a new HBO series starring Jason Bateman and David Harbour, kind of like a murder mystery type of thing. Let me tell you this. I've seen the trailers for this. I've seen the promos for the show. HBO Max did a piss poor job of selling what the show is, because what the show is the next series from Stephen Conrad, the creator of Patriot, the writer of The Weatherman. And whenever this guy is involved with something, I'm like there, because he has a unique brand of just like weird, quirky, absurd humor. And this show is very much that. This is about two coworkers and like
Patriot, yeah. Not the Patriot, the TV show.
Patriot, the TV show.
Not the Patriot, the Roland Emmerich action film, right?
No, why? Yeah. Nobody would ever reference the Patriot, but okay. In what purpose, whatever reason would I have to do that? But Patriot was a show about a depressed spy who wanted to be a folk singer. And the comedy just kind of came from there. Right. And this show is about middle-aged friends. They're kind of coworkers. And they're both like just dealing with like sexless marriages, basically. Right. They're like, they're kind of unhappy. They start talking about this app where married people can like get together and hook up anonymously, I guess. And somebody gets killed. And there's a mystery about what all of that is. But what this show really is fucking hilarious. Because I think Stephen Conrad, practically every line of dialogue, practically every scene of this show is just so weird and funny in a way that is like hard to describe. So if you liked Patriot and you like that weird, like offbeat sense of humor that it had, I think you'd be very much at home here. Patriot, if you want to understand the greatness of Patriot, look up Kurtwood Smith Patriot Monologue. And this is that was a show that had Kurtwood Smith just saying the most ridiculous things about the principles of the structural dynamics of flow, about piping and different things. They made Kurtwood Smith, it was like a super dense, complex, very specific monologue that lasted 2 minutes, and he had to go. It was all one take, I believe, too. But it was hilarious. And this show kind of gets that too. Jason Bateman plays a weatherman. He rides a recumbent bike. You can't take anybody who rides a recumbent bike seriously. I'm sorry.
How dare you?
I'm sorry.
It's purely for ergonomic reasons, Devendra.
I'm sure that's what he tells himself.
I know it doesn't look cool, but yeah. It's better
does
for
not
the
look
spine.
Cool at all.
Better for the spine. Okay.
We Richard Jenkins people. Is Richard Jenkins is in this too. Richard Jenkins is the police detective, one of the police people trying to like figure out this case. Richard Jenkins looks at this bike and he's like, "Is this a nerd thing? What the hell is this?"
You know what it is, actually? Yeah. It's somebody trying to take care of their body.
Take care of their knees.
Work out while still...
You would fit yeah. right into the world of DTF St. Louis.
You know what the coolest thing is, objectively cool? Caring about your spine.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah,
caring about your spine and your knees.
Objectively the coolest thing.
Absolutely.
Let me tell you about the kind of humor in this show, right? So David Harbour is married to Linda Cardellini. Linda Cardellini works as an umpire. He cannot have sex with her because he can only imagine Linda Cardellini in the umpire outfit. So like a big boxy. So he was like, "I can't do it."
And that's a turn off to
that's
him?
I
don't understand
off?
This.
That's a turn off.
I don't get that. Show has lost me. Already the show
Dave,
has lost me.
Dave just thinking about it and he's no longer recumbent.
Anyway. it's stuff like that. It's like he's married to one of the most beautiful women alive, but she's an umpire. Just can't get that image out of my head. I think both of you guys would enjoy the show. Do not be fooled by the trailers at HBO, which make it seem like another seedy HBO murder mystery. No, this is a dark comedy and it's hilarious. Like every aspect of it is hilarious. Richard Jenkins kind of like battling out with Joy Sunday, who's I believe a crime scene investigator as well. They're just trying to determine like their jurisdiction over this. It's really funny. I think of, this is one of those shows where I just think of lines or I think of scenes or scenarios. I'm like, I just start laughing because they waste no time. It is just funny. And even the way it sets certain things up, like at one point, Jason Bateman's in interrogation with Richard Jenkins in the most brutalist Blade Runner-esque room you've ever seen. Like the room makes no sense because it's like slanted windows, stone pillars that they're sitting on. Like nothing about it makes sense. At one point, Richard Jenkins is getting ready for to raid a place to arrest somebody with a bunch of policemen. And he says, "Ready up, guys," or something like that. And all the policemen in unison, like henchmen, are saying, "Ready up, ready up, ready up," as they're going up the hill. It's hilarious. I think the show is hilarious. I cannot wait to see the rest of it. Stephen Conrad, give him all the money to make weird art and weird shows. This show is fantastic.
I've heard it's great as well. The comp I hear, Devendra, is like, it's like Barry, the HBO original series.
It is kind of like Barry. And the thing is, HBO had Barry, and they kind of knew how to sell the weirdness of Barry. I do not understand, in the trailers I've seen, no hint of the actual comedy or weirdness of the show. So that was kind of strange. And
debatable that they knew how to sell Barry, FYI. Like, I don't think that show did. I obviously love the show. I don't think it did particularly well from what I can tell. But
yeah.
Anyway, DTF St. Louis, I can't wait to check this out. So, it is available right now on HBO Max. All right, Jeff Cannata, hit us up with something you watched this week.
I just wanted to circle back and mention that I finished the Prime Video series Steel. I talked about that, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, I think. It's only 6 episodes, each is an hour. This is that heist show about the sort of banking institution getting knocked over by a group of highly trained people. But it has some twists and turns. I don't think the last 3 are as strong as the first 3, but I think the show is still very much recommendable. I had a blast with it. It's it gets mired in a bit of a kind of relationshipy morass that I don't think the show needed. We didn't need to have a little romantic thingy happening, but that's okay. It's still fun, and there is a final twisty kind of fun thing that happens at the end. It's not the twist that I thought was going to be. Which is, I thought I had it nailed. I thought I knew exactly what the final, heisty twist was going to be, but it wasn't. It was something else. And I think it's still fun. So I just wanted to mention it again. Steel on Prime Video is very much worth watching, especially if you're like me and you dig a heist. You dig a fun, kind of taut, you know, compressed one of the thriller like this. I dig it.
Very cool. Steel is on Prime Video. And yeah, what is it about all heist movies? Every heist movie ends with a twist of some kind, right? Like,
well, I think
the Ocean's movies kind of broke the genre, right? After Ocean's, you kind of have to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what's fun about them, mm-hmm. right? That's one of the things I enjoy about the subgenre. But as I said last time we talked about this, I think this show has a few more twists than I would have thought. Like, each of the first 3 episodes kind of resets the table mm-hmm. in a really fun way. And it stops doing that at a certain point. But then the end, it kind of has a fun
cool
flippity-do. And I think this is very worth watching. I don't know why nobody is talking about this show. I think it's an excellent show.
It's called Steel. It's on Prime Video. Let us know.
They're not talking about it because it's on Prime Video.
How dare you?
Yeah.
And people should check it out. I had a chance to watch Taylor Tomlinson's newest Netflix special called Prodigal Daughter.
I watched that too.
Jeff, I think you watched this as well. Yeah. And I got to say, I quite enjoyed it. This is a very religion heavy special. She spends a lot of time talking about religion, her Christian upbringing, religious trauma. Also talks about coming out as queer not too long ago. And
this whole thing is inside a chapel, basically.
Inside a church, which is like... Yeah. I don't
odd place ever for seeing comedy. Before.
Right. Yeah. Very strange. Very strange. But I have to say, I thought it was very, very solid. I enjoyed this quite a bit. And I would recommend it. It's been wonderful to see Taylor Tomlinson's comedy and technique and abilities evolve over the course of the last few years. All of her specials have done pretty well. This one is one of the top things on Netflix as we're recording this. And I think she's great. What do you think, Jeff Cannata?
I agree with all that. Yeah, I think she's great. I've enjoyed her previous specials as well. I think she's whip smart and funny and very self-deprecating. Yeah, it's a little odd at the beginning. You know, you start with, right. I think, like choral music and you know, stained glass windows and pews. It's like, whoa, that, kind of an audacious place to go in and
absolutely,
you know, say,
yeah,
say
and it's
dirty
like
jokes,
all,
basically.
A lot of comedy specials look the same, right? And so this is definitely like a bold gambit to do it in a place that's very visually striking and different than other places. Jeff Cannata, I know you can relate with this. I have a pet peeve around the term prodigal son. I think we probably have discussed this on the podcast before.
Yes.
Right? Which is, a lot of people use the term prodigal son. Not very many people use it correctly.
Correct. Yeah, you're right.
It does not just mean somebody who left and came back.
Right.
And I'm tired of people being, the prodigal son returns. Every single time somebody says that in a movie or TV show, I say out loud, that's not what that means. My wife loves this about me.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I'm just joking. She doesn't love it, but
you have to be a little bit of a screw up to be a prodigal son.
Yeah, or something. It's whatever it is, special, right? Define it
special.
Okay. No, I guess I have to explain it. No, I'm going to do a public
you
service.
You set up the table. Now you got to do the work. Apparently,
isn't a prodigal son a like the screw up, the black sheep, the like bad the one who's
Not what that means. That's not what prodigal.
I never.
Means.
Yeah.
So
prodigal means reckless, doesn't it?
I now profited. I have to look it up. But
expert has to look it up now.
Well, I just now Jeff's calling me out on the definition. Right here is the definition from Oxford.
Person who leaves home and behaves recklessly,
spending money or resources freely and recklessly, wastefully, extravagant.
Nailed it.
No, that's right. Jeff, I wasn't saying reckless is wrong. I'm saying reckless is part of the definition. Okay.
No, you said that wasn't it. You said that wasn't it.
Well, that's not quite right. That's not quite right. Like it's
so
not just
wrong then.
All right. So the story of the prodigal son is this father has two sons, right? And one of them is, I believe, the older son, super well behaved and always listens to what his dad says. The younger son's like, hey, dad, I want my inheritance now, which is that his way of saying, I can't wait for you to die. Mm-hmm. Please die and give me my money. So then the father's like, well, that's very sad, but he gives his son his money. And the son goes out and spends it on wild living, you know, just like goes all out.
Reckless, one might say.
We don't exactly know what he did, right? But we know he probably ate some things and fucked some things and, you know, like did all kinds of shit, right? And
reckless.
That's right, Jeff. That captures reckless. Most of it. But not necessarily the entirety of the definition of what I was trying to go for. Anyway, so then the prodigal son is like, oh my God, I've lost everything. I've spent the whole inheritance. I'm going to go back home now and beg my father for his mercy. So he goes back home, and then the father's like, my son has returned. The prodigal son has returned. It is amazing. And let's throw a big party. Why would you be celebrating that? We're going to invite
That's what I didn't understand.
We're going to invite everyone to the party. And then the old son is like, the older brother's like, dad, like you didn't throw me a party. I did everything you asked for over the course of last
year. The whole time.
I was the good kid. That's right.
I did everything you asked for. Like, I'm so freaking bitter. Why are you giving this guy a celebration just for coming back? And he's like, hey, you know what? You have done everything. The dad's like, you have done everything I asked, but you know what? Today's a day for celebration. You know, let's put aside these minor issues and just celebrate that your brother has come home.
Yeah. And the story of Bloodline, the show.
Yeah, right? Basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's this kind of story about how, like,
It does not pay to be good, apparently. That's the story.
It does make being good very unattractive, right?
Yeah, it does.
It's a story of forgiveness and acceptance.
That's right. It's like
familial.
No matter what you've done, Like the father is always willing to accept you back into the tent, you know, it's kind of what it is.
Yeah.
And and that people who have been in the tent the whole time shouldn't be bitter that someone's out there eating and fucking his way through all his dad's money. Like he,
yeah, you should, it's about the return. It's about returning.
It's about the return.
You, it, you know, it's the deathbed confession. It's the, it, as yeah. long as you at the end of the story are contrite.
Yeah, I don't know that that's supposed to be the takeaway, what you're saying.
I think that's all the religion but stuff.
But you're right. Like, you're right that that's certainly implied by the story. Yeah. You know? But yeah. anyway.
It's as long as you come back, prodigal son. Well-behaved son, get fucked. You know what I'm saying?
Well, the idea is that the well-behaved son also has a seat at the dad's table, but it's just not like, he's just not going to be like a big deal. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like,
he's not being celebrated.
He's not being celebrated.
He's not for him.
He's not being celebrated. Yeah. But you know what? Like, do we really, he doesn't, he's so good, he probably doesn't need to be celebrated. You know what I mean? Like,
you know, the story is so timeless. It's been repeated over and over again. We're never going to leave it, as we recently saw in The Wrecking Crew. This is a story right. forever will be repeated. Yeah.
Anyway, so, that's Taylor Tomlinson's new special.
New special, Prodigal Daughter. And you out there listening right now, next time somebody uses the term prodigal son, you can push your glasses up your nose, look down upon them and say, that's not what that means. No, unless, say, of course,
oh,
they're...
Because that's oh, what you're saying love. Your son was a screw-up. You're saying yeah. your son is a
unless, of course, they were using that correct... Unless, of course, they were using that term correctly, in which case, do not do that. But I would
and
say
you
about...
Say, I'm so happy your child was a screw-up. I'm so happy you're using that term correctly. You understand.
Well done.
That's what you're saying. That's well what done. You're saying.
Oh, with so your son's a horrible...
Of your progeny.
Yeah. Your son's a horrible fuck-up, I see. Oh, okay. All right. Okay. But yes, yeah, anyway, something to keep in mind next time people use that term. Taylor Tomlinson's
well,
product...
Well, I think the just to put a button on this, I yes, think the trajectory of how this has been misinterpreted is that it has often been used ironically. The prodigal son returns. Oh, you've been off screwing and being a jerk. That's and then it became just, oh, you've left and now you're back.
Yeah, so
it lost its meaning because people were using it ironically.
I've often that's seen it used in media where it's like the good son or daughter or whatever leaves and comes back.
Exactly. Yeah. It's complete nonsense. Like it's completely detached from its original meaning at this point. And so you out there, listener, right there, the person who I'm talking to right now, you can help restore meaning. Just like we've already lost the literally wars, right? Like,
yeah, no, I am on board with your pedantry. You know me. I'm the guy that enforces celibate versus chaste, you know? People say celibate absolutely. When they mean chaste. There's two words because they have two different meanings. Sorry, go ahead.
Check out Taylor Tomlinson's Prodigal Daughter on Netflix right now. It's something Jeff and I have been watching this week. Devinder Hardware, something you've been watching this week?
A bunch of some things. So my wife and I are Ghostbusters fans, and it turns out my kids are also Ghostbusters fans. And when kids become fans of something, they just want to watch it over and over and over and over. So we have been rewatching Ghostbusters 1 and 2, Ghostbusters Answer the Call, and Ghostbusters, what was the other one called? Afterlife. They do not know the other movie exists.
Wow.
Frozen Empire.
No Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, huh?
No Frozen. They don't know it exists. I'm going to keep it that way for as long as I can. But no, my kids are really into Ghostbusters. My daughter is 7. My son is almost 4, but we skip past like weird stuff and he is not freaked out by the scary stuff. I've been like careful about some of that. They just love it. They love the humor. They love Slimer. My son loves the Marshmallow Man from the first movie. They love the pink slime from the second movie. But what I think is really interesting is my daughter really, really likes Ghostbusters Answer the Call. And the reason for that is because it's all girls. It's all girls and the boys are the bad guys. That's pretty much it. So like she is not as into Ghostbusters 1 because she's like the boys are annoying, which is kind of true. So much of that movie is annoying boy and male energy and also kind of toxic Bill Murray often of the time. She really enjoys Answer the Call and watching that movie, which I haven't done since we reviewed it because there's no goddamn reason to. But I've been watching the extended edition of that movie, which has some more stuff in it. It has like a dance sequence that was cut. You know, like that movie isn't totally terrible. I wish that cast had another chance to kind of do it right because there is so much talent in that movie. And it's a shame we just kind of memory hold it. It's just kind of totally forgotten. I would say the improv stuff didn't quite work. Some of it kind of still holds up. My biggest gripe with Answer the Call right now is that it is just god-awful ugly. Like, I don't know what Paul Feig was doing, but that is the most saturated movie I have seen in a very long time. And I've been watching clips of Speed Racer on this TV. This movie is just cranked up in a way that is like really garish in TV again. So I don't know what's going on there. But yeah, they like that. And they really like Afterlife because it's kids. It's the Goonies formula, but with Ghostbusters. And that is such a winning combination. I still think Afterlife works as like a family drama. It's really the nostalgia stuff that kills that movie, but it's still like totally watchable. So yeah, been doing a lot of Ghostbusters. My kids are really into it and I feel proud.
This gives me an opportunity to summarize the plot of Ghostbusters 2 for you guys, if you'd like.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Had them throwing a party for a bunch of children when all the while the slime was under the building.
Yep.
So they packed up and holed up, got a grip, came equipped with their proton packs in the backs, and they split. His name is Viggo, the master of evil, trying to battle my boys. Yo, that ain't legal. That's the plot of Ghostbusters 2.
Bravo. Bravo. Well, that's all the Ghostbusters movies. Devinder, how'd you watch these?
I mean, you know, wherever. Actually, I think I bought a bundle a while back on Apple TV, so we have it. We got the Apple TV. And I have to say, if you like bits of Answer the Call, it may be worth checking out the extended edition. There's like a whole boyfriend character that wasn't there in the original movie. Like there's stuff in there that's kind of fun.
Very cool. That is something Devinder Hardwar has been watching this week. Let's take another break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more of what we've been watching right after this. Jeff Cannata, hit us up with something you watched this week.
Checked out a new half-hour comedy on Peacock. It's called...
Did you pull something saying that?
Yeah.
That's how you say it.
Yeah. Peacock? I just watched the Peacock.
That's how you say it.
It's called The Fall and Rise of Reggie Deakins. This is a new, I want to say, you know, I'm always looking for half hour comedies. It fits a particularly wonderful place for my wife and I in our watching. You know, oftentimes you just want to something a little easy, a little pleasant. Give me a laugh. Give me a chuckle. Give me something that's not too long, and you know, just want a little.
I just want to feel something, man. I just want to feel something.
And this, I think, going into it, just because it has Tracy Morgan, Daniel Radcliffe for the stars, it's got that 30 Rock vibe that I love. I love the 30 Rock tempo, and you guys know that basically, The Office changed all half-hour comedies, certainly all network half-hour comedies. It changed the world. Some might argue for the worse. Some might argue it ruined all half-hour comedies because all half-hour comedies that networks produce post The Office, it seems, have to be mockumentary style. The Fall and Rise of Reggie Deakins is no different. It is the same. It is also a mockumentary style. But what I like about this show is that, you know, a lot of these office style shows, they just sort of, the way The Office did, they just sort of assume that you understand that there's a documentary crew doing this and they talk to the camera because it's a documentary crew and we're not going to talk about it. We're not going to introduce the crew. We're not going to set it up in any way. You get it because you watch The Office. Mm-hmm. So all these shows can do it. What's fun about The Fall and Rise of Reggie Deakins is that it's kind of about the documentary being made, and it is Daniel Radcliffe as the documentarian, a famed Oscar-winning documentarian, who is now doing a documentary to sort of rehabilitate his own career about Tracy Morgan's Reggie Deakins character. And so it very much is a comedic half-hour sitcom about the making of something like Last Dance. Mm-hmm. So Last Dance with the Chicago Bulls and Michael Jordan, or you know, those kinds of sports documentaries, specifically more the rehabilitation sports documentary, which Last Dance wasn't exactly. But it's that same format where we're following Tracy Morgan around. He used to be a famed NFL running back, and he got himself into a gambling controversy, lost his career, And now he's trying to rehabilitate his image through the use of this documentary that has full access to his life and his family. He got this Oscar award winning documentarian in the form of Daniel Radcliffe to direct it. And of course, silliness ensues because his life is ridiculous. I'm having a blast with this. I like the fact that in a mockumentary style, the documentariness of it is actually a plot point rather than just the format, you know? I think it does have that 30 Rock sort of joke style that things can be absurd, things can be quick, things can be throwaway that are really funny. Bobby Moynihan is also in this, plays Tracy Morgan's like best friend and kind of OJ's accomplice guy's name?
Al Cowling.
Yeah.
Comes to mind? Al Cowling.
He's going to support him no matter what, you know, through all his screw ups and all his moral failings. There's a lot of comedy to be had. I'm into it. I think this is a very funny show. First two episodes are available as of right now on Peacock. I'm into this. I'm going to keep watching it. Wife and I are enjoying it. We're laughing. We like it.
Very cool.
They really, that should be the new motto for Peacock, like the Yahoo Yodel, you know, like you got to make it the Peacock Caw or whatever.
Yeah.
The Fall and Rise of Reggie Dinkins is on Peacock. And Robert Carlock, one of the showrunners who was a showrunner on 30 Rock. So I think it sounds like it's successfully carried over that DNA.
I definitely was laughing quite a lot. And, you know, not everything works. It's not, you know, but these shows, first season of 30 Rock was not great either. And there's something about Tracy Morgan, man. Nobody has a delivery like Tracy Morgan.
Mm-hmm. He's so unpredictable.
It's so funny. Yeah. Like everything he says, it feels like he doesn't believe he's actually saying it. You know, it's like he's... There's a facade to all his delivery that is like, I don't even believe the words that are coming out of my mouth. And yet it completely works. You know, there's something about his delivery that's very funny. And I'm always down for some Tracy Morgan. So good stuff.
Awesome. Fall and Rise of Reggie Dinkins on Peacock. Well, Jeff, this week
it happened.
I had a chance to watch Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie.
Yes.
And the way this happened, first of all, I just want to say I am going to reveal some of the premise. It will not be enough to spoil anything, in my opinion. But I am going to talk about the extremely basic premise of this film.
So before you do that, though, I will tell you how many people have messaged me and said, I just went based on your recommendation, didn't know anything about it, and I'm so glad I didn't know anything.
That's
what
fine.
A ride.
I just
want to put that out there.
Yeah, yeah. I'm convinced that nothing I reveal will ruin people's experience of the film. But... somebody heard my plea. Somebody heard our plea on this podcast. I want to give a shout out to Kit out there who helped to connect me to some people who were able to get me a screener of this film.
Nice. Thank you, Kit.
Thank you, Kit. Really appreciate your efforts. And so I was able to watch Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie, which is out in theaters right now in the United States. You know, there's a lot of questions about whether or not Jeff can accurately predict what Dave Chen will like, and vice versa. You know, like, I think my Jeff-o-meter is completely shot to shit at this point. Is Jeff's Dave-o-meter any good? And I am really sad to inform you all that Jeff is exactly right in this case. This movie is
woo!
Incredible. I mean,
Best movies!
Not only is it incredible, it is an early contender for number one film of 2026.
Right? Yes!
Like, I mean... The extremely basic plot is it's about two guys who are trying to put on a show, a music show, in a popular Canadian music venue. You know, that is the goal that they're trying to achieve.
They just want to show at the Rivoli, even though they have no songs.
They have no songs, and they haven't written the songs or an act or anything like that.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. But they want a show at the Rivoli.
But they want to do the show at the Rivoli.
One way or another.
They're going to do a show one way or the other. And so it kind of chronicles their efforts at doing this. And again, I'm not, like, I agree with you, Jeff. There's some amazing surprises in this movie that I will not discuss here on this podcast. I am also, in general, going to say go see it without any any knowledge of the plot or without reading anything, you know, because many of the reviews will give away some of these plot details that I think you're trying to conceal from people. I will just say, first of all, like in terms of this being a kind of bromance between these two guys, right? Like it's like a kind of heartwarming story of male friendship, like at its very core. And secondly, some of the stuff the movie does, you know, Jeff already said it all very well. So I'm not going to repeat too much of it, but I'll just say that as Jeff indicated, it does feel like a magic trick. It does feel like this is a movie that keeps one-upping itself. It does feel like you will leave this movie wondering, how did they do that? How did they achieve that? How did they like accomplish that? And it turns out by the seat of their pants. Like it's actually, if you go and look at the making of, it's remarkable. Which is
even, I think it's even, that makes it even better. Like that it literally is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As miraculous as it seems, like the things you're witnessing on screen aren't some $500 million thing. They just figured it out.
Yeah,
you know,
yep,
and that's awesome. Yep.
One thing I will say, Jeff, is, and this is you find this out in the first few seconds, is that this is a found footage movie, and I think it uses found footage in a way that is. That really furthers the storytelling in a way unlike most found footage films. Like they really like, it's like, wow, this is one of the best uses of found footage movies I've ever seen. You know, just like they figured out a way to make it fit intricately with the footage they were able to get. And I think that it's amazing what they've been able to accomplish with just the found footage format as a genre. So I think the movie's phenomenal. It is basically genetically engineered so that people on this podcast, or sorry, people listening to this podcast will like it.
That's right. It is for us.
It is for us. It is for us. And I laughed. I cried. I was in awe. I was like, this is the most, one of the most audacious things I have ever witnessed. I'm a little bummed. Like the thing is, this is called Nirvana, the Band, the Show, the Movie. And I'm a little bummed that the title like doesn't do a particularly good job of selling the movie. But then having seen the film, it's like,
it's the perfect title.
It's like, that's, I understand why they titled it that way. You know, like these are comedians that have committed to the bit in an extreme way.
For decades, they've committed to the bit.
Yeah. And so it's like, they couldn't not do it. Even if the title is actively alienating and off-putting for people,
that's right.
They have to do it this way.
Yeah.
So I am glad you mentioned it. I'm so grateful to listener Kit for hooking me up with this screener and helping me out with the folks at Neon over there. And I cannot recommend this movie highly enough. Like, do not you must go out and see this movie.
You must.
You must.
It's only in theaters for a couple more days, at least in my area. So you'll have a shot.
If you're listening to this, you probably have 48 hours to go see this movie. You must go see it. Now, all
that
said,
until Thursday. Yeah.
All that said, Neon has acquired the rights, I believe, to not only this film, but also the entire series. So, and they will apparently do have plans to release it. So I do think like at some point, there will be some ability to like buy a digital box set of all the Nirvana, the band, the movie stuff, you know, like all and to consume it all in like in its ideal form. But yeah, I mean, this is a special one. It is like Jeff said, it is for us. It is a film nerd speaking to other film nerds. And there's just so many amazing, wonderful moments in this film. Cannot recommend it highly enough. Check it out. So,
David, my heart is so large right now. We need to get Devendra into the cult as well.
Yes. I'm going to be in this, but I want to say, guys, this is no surprise. This is no surprise we like this movie because we freaking loved the BlackBerry movie, a movie
Matt
that
Johnson.
Shouldn't exist or be as good as it does, and it's from the same dude. So,
I'm going to say this too, Jeff, and I don't know if anyone's going to appreciate this, but when I saw this movie, I felt seen in one other specific way, other than being a film nerd, which is, I think my body type is similar to Matt Johnson's. And what I mean by that is when you look at Matt Johnson, it's like, oh, this is kind of like a doughy kind of dude. But then at one point in the movie, you see Matt Johnson's arms and he's like pretty jacked. And
humble brag, Mr. Chen.
And that is the balance that my body involuntarily is striking these days. You know, like it's not like I want that, but I'm like, oh, like there's someone else that kind of has that look. And yeah. That was nice to see as well.
I don't want to, you know, no spoilers for anything, but there is a very funny interview with those two dudes where they revealed that the premise of this movie came from how do we accentuate the way we look? How do we make the way we look into a positive for this movie?
Mm-hmm.
And they succeeded in doing that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mind blowing movie. Can't stop thinking about it. Recommend it in the strongest terms possible. One of the best films of 2020. Like, really,
Movie to beat right now.
It is number one movie of 2026 for me, David Chen.
Yep.
It is hard to imagine a movie surpassing it.
That's right.
In the next 10 months, right?
Yeah. It's like when I watched Mad Max Fury Road or when I watched Everything Everywhere All at Once. It's just like, I know I've seen the best movie I'm going to see this year.
It is that level movie in my opinion. That level. Yeah. All right. Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie. Something I've been watching this week. Thanks to Kit for helping me out with the screener. All right, Devendra Hardwar, you're something else you've been watching this week.
Yeah, another shout out for industry because the season is over. Season 4, incredible television, incredible stuff. Watch industry. I know you guys watch some of it. I will say, thinking back to season 1, the show as it is now is unrecognizable from what season 1 was. Like, just has changed so much between seasons. But freaking Emmy level performance for Kit Harington. Like just what he goes through in the season. It is tremendous stuff. Great new cast. And the show ended up doing something I didn't quite expect. It slowly built up this thing. I'm not going to say like who it's referring to, but it sort of like explores the psychology of how somebody would become like a Ghislaine Maxwell. Basically, like how does that happen? And the show builds to that in ways I did not quite expect. So that is interesting as well. Tremendous TV. Like the thing is, like, I thought Sunday nights would be a little boring without, you know, Night of the Seven Kingdoms and industry together, but we got DTF St. Louis and industry for at least one weekend. So that was a lot of fun. Check out industry and definitely check out DTF St. Louis.
That's going to bring us to the end of what we've been watching this week. Let's get to some weekly plugs. We're going to do weekly plugs. Weekly plugs, a part of the show each week where we plug something else we've been making. I want to throw a shout out for decodingeverything.com, my free newsletter. I wrote up my thoughts on Scream 7, but not only that, I kind of did a recap of the Scream franchise in general and everything that went down with Scream 7 and all the casting stuff that occurred, and then also shared my thoughts on Scream 7, the film as well. So if you want to check all that out, decodingeverything.com, you can subscribe for free. Check it out, decodingeverything.com. Devendra Hardwar, your weekly plug.
Yeah, I joined the guys at the Make Me Watch It podcast to talk about Scarlet. That's the new Mamoru Hosoda film I talked about last week. I didn't really love the film that much, but it is very beautiful. So yeah, check out that episode if you want to hear me more, talk more about Scarlet and Hosoda's work in general.
All right, guys, quick question before we start the review today, which is, what do you call a website where you can watch horror movies online? What do you call a website where you can watch horror movies online? Jeff Cannata, your weekly plug.
I'd call it Ha! Do you remember those old commercials? Do you remember those commercials? Am I too old? There used to be the commercials for the Comedy Network. Before Comedy Central absorbed all the comedy networks, there was a comedy network called Ha. And there was a commercial for it that said, what would you call a network that's all comedy all the time? And then it's like this old lady, she goes, I'd call it Ha! And that was a commercial. Anyway.
Did not know about that. But that is, yeah, I love the blast from the past, Jeff.
It's got to be late 80s. Yeah.
So the late 1900s, I think, is what you're... Right?
That's right, the late 1900s. Mm-hmm, he said, withering into dust. My party... Or not party. That's a different show. My weekly plug is a web video on the official Marvel YouTube page. That is a three-part? I can't remember if it's three-part and four-part. Anyway, multi-part Doctor Doom recap. If you're excited about Robert Downey Jr. taking on the role of Doctor Doom, if you're excited about the next Avengers films that are right around the corner this summer coming out, and you want to get up to speed on Doctor Doom, the history of Doctor Doom from Marvel Comics, comprehensive history of Doctor Doom. And if additionally, you don't mind my voice, boy, do I have a video for you, or several videos, actually.
Oh, man. One out of two is not bad, though, right?
You don't care about Dr. Doom, dude? I have been fortunate enough to be hired again by Marvel to voice a recap video. These are long. This one, you know, last one was like 2 hours. This time they've broken up it into chunks, which I think is smarter. But this gives you all the history of Dr. Doom. So much fun. I got to do a fun Dr. Doom voice. I'm kind of in full intense Doom mode doing this. And
all right,
I'm
Jeff,
proud
I'm
of it.
I'm sorry, Jeff. I got to ask, like, can you do a little Dr. Doom voice for us?
No, you got to watch the video, Dave. This is how you tease the video.
Wow.
And if you like the video.
You can't even give us a little taste of it, huh?
Doom. No, it is... it was fun. It was very fun. And so I'm hoping to do even more of these. This is the third one I've done, I think. I did Fantastic Four. I did a Red Hulk and this one. So I'm hoping to do more of them. So, you know, if you find yourself able to put a little comment on the YouTube video saying, hey, I love the narrator, it won't hurt. Might be too late already. It's been out over a week, so they might stop paying attention to that stuff, but it doesn't hurt. Anyway, check it out. It's fun. I think it's useful. They do a really good job of editing these with comic book panels, and you know, the imagery is really great, and it does give you a comprehensive view of the character, which is really fun. So there you go, Marvel Zombie from way back, getting to live his dream and voicing official Marvel content over on YouTube.
I think people should compete to comment in such a way that that comment gets a lot of upvotes, and then like it's at the top of the page. You know what I mean?
Go.
So like,
yeah,
this narrator is so amazing that ... and then 1,000 upvotes. Bing, bang, boom, you're being invited to do the next Marvel narration for whatever the next character, Shang-Chi 2, probably, you know?
There you go. Yeah.
There you go. Patreon.com/filmpodcast, so you can support this podcast, help to keep it going, and get ad-free episodes, exclusive bonus episodes, and early access to episodes. Of course, we just had our Dan Trachtenberg interview last week about Predator Badlands. Where we talked about the making of Predator Badlands with Dan Trachtenberg for over an hour. What a fun chat that was, guys. And so much fun and so fascinating to hear his process for creating all the wonderful concepts and ideas in the film. Loved chatting with him, and patrons got to hear that conversation before anyone else at patreon.com/filmpodcast. Of course, we never want anyone to donate. If it in any way causes them financial hardship, you can always support us for free by leaving a star rating for us wherever you get your podcast. It takes a few seconds. It makes a big difference. Please consider it. Let's get to our review of Scream 7.
Hello?
Hello, Sydney. Did you miss me? Nice little town you found. You and your pretty daughter reminds me of where we grew up.
Well, you sure know a lot about me for another asshole hiding behind a voice changer.
Oh, I'm not hiding, Sydney. Not this time.
A screaming service. A screaming service.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Coming from you,
there actually already is one, though, isn't there?
I know. It's Shudder.
I think Shudder used that tagline at some point.
Yeah, but it's a screaming service, guys. That's what they should call it. All right, anyway. Welcome to the Filmcast review of Scream 7. I'm going to read the plot summary of this film from IMDb. When a new ghost-face killer emerges in the town where Sydney Prescott has built a new life, her darkest fears are realized as her daughter becomes the next target, end quote. Guys, this franchise has had its ups and downs over the years. For a while, it seemed like this franchise wouldn't even come back. Now it is back in a different form than was originally intended, which we will discuss momentarily. All that said, let's talk about the movie itself. Devinder Hardwar, what did you think of Scream 7?
This movie is a complete disaster, creatively, in every way. This movie feels like a mess. And you can trace all this back to the decision to basically give up on the characters they were building for Scream 5 and Scream 6. Especially,
there was a new group of characters introduced in those films called the Core Four. I don't know that I appreciated that name, but it was it's a reasonable thing to try and do of, hey, we're building a new franchise or a new phase of the franchise off of different people than have been there for the first five films.
And different creative energy too, right? It was the Radio Silence guys. I thought Scream 5 and 6 were excellent. We reviewed them. We loved them. I'll also say this is one of my favorite horror franchises because I was always a Wes Craven fan. And I thought the way the original Scream deconstructed horror movies and slashers was freaking brilliant in the 90s. And, you know, it's had its ups and downs. There are aspects of Scream 2 and Scream 3 that I like quite a bit. But I thought Scream 4, also by Wes Craven, was also a lot of fun. So I've got a lot of love for this franchise. I've got a lot of love for Neve Campbell and everybody. But I can't help but look at this movie and be like, wow, the way the studio basically reacted to Melissa Barrera standing up for, you know, Palestine was shitty. And Jenna Ortega kind of followed her, too, because she thought the studio was treating Melissa Barrera shitty. And what we end up with.
And also, by the way, Christopher Landon departed in addition to those things, which I agree was bad. Christopher Landon left the franchise as well.
One of the most exciting horror comedy directors right now, like the premier guy to make movies like this.
The guy who directed Freaky and Drop, just like a very talented director as well. So like the entire creative team, or sort of the director and two of the biggest stars left, and with them the original ideas for what Scream 7 would be.
So what you have, the movie that we're left is a freaking wet fart. And Kevin Williamson writing and directing, like Kevin Williamson created the idea of Scream, right? He is the original screenwriter. I have a lot of love for him and his ideas, although he has made other things that were not good, especially TV shows. But this is such a clueless and artless and boring movie. It's not even so bad it's fun. It's just kind of there. Because like it just goes through the motions, it gives you the kills, it does the like requisite like a tying into the lore or tying into past killers, brings back certain characters, whatever. It is just so obscenely boring. I was already angry at this film for the casting choices because I thought the whole direction they were going with Melissa Barrera and Jenna Ortega was fantastic. Even if the last movie was like it was a little overwrought, but I thought it was at least fun. What they were doing.
Bring the Scream franchise into like with new characters in it.
Yeah.
But Scream 7 also put them into the big city, right? New York City. Scream 6. Yeah. Put them into New York City. And it's like, oh, wow. Like kind of a fresh take on a very tired franchise at that point.
Yeah. Even though they didn't really use New York City to like the fullest that they could have, like there was something there. And I don't think they actually filmed
a lot of it in New York City, to be clear. But
no,
like, at least they were trying to do something different, is what I'm trying to say. You know,
Different, different setting, different something. This is another like nondescript suburb that this is in. I don't buy the relationship between Sydney and her daughter at all. It's all just so dull and so boring. It feels like, I think Bill Gabberi had a great like takedown review of this, and it just feels like a movie that had to be made and not a movie that has any like actual creative energy or juice behind it. I feel sad for this movie. I feel sad for everybody who decided to be in this movie as well. You got to make a paycheck. I get it. Like not people aren't out there hiring Neve Campbell. But still, this is such a disappointment, not just bad, utterly boring.
Jeff Cannata, your thoughts on Scream 7.
Well, Dave, I guess you could say my thoughts on Scream 7 are best summed up in the form of a limerick.
Let's hear it, Jeff.
An iconic and crucial linchpin to the way each Scream movie begins is the creepy phone call. But with this new install, meant the rest of the film phones it in.
Nice. I thought lovely, you were going to go with... a rhyme of Matt Bettinelli Olpin, who is one of the members of Radio Silence, who is originally, you know, behind this new set of Scream movies and such.
Shockingly, so. I did not.
Would have also accepted Matt Bettinelli Olpin as the rhyme at the end there. Just gonna put that out there. All right. Jeff Cannata.
No, I agree with every single thing that Devendra said. This movie is shockingly dull. That said, I'm still in love with Neve Campbell. I'm sorry.
I mean, yeah, how can you?
I loved watching her she's like, she gives this effortless performance. She's very grounded. Yeah. I really liked her in this. And I think she needs to get more work. She's just a lovely actor and still, you know, stunning, aging elegantly. I'm a big Neve Campbell. I mean, I'm in the pocket for Neve Campbell. You know, I can't get over that. So it was cool to see her back. Crazy that they literally make her apologize in the context of the movie for missing the last movie. She literally, like, he literally forces her to apologize. Kevin Williamson, in writing the script, like, I'm going to make her say, I'm sorry I didn't go to New York last time.
It kind of feels like he's shitting on the last movie, though.
It kind of feels very weird. Yeah.
Yes, extremely, yeah.
Anyway, everything else other than Neve Campbell's presence is just so bad. It really does feel like it's phoned in. It really does feel like the laziest, which is wild because it's the series' original creator at the helm with the script. And it is so paint by numbers. It is sleepwalking through all the beats that you would expect. And nothing really makes any sense. I can't wait to talk in spoilers about the reveal because it's just one of the most limp, boring reveals in series history. And, you know, the whole structure of how it's set up is really weird. What I love about the Scream franchise, and I've said this before, I think it's like the third Scream movie that I've written a limerick for. So, that, you know, it's, I haven't been writing limericks that long. I love that the Scream franchise is basically a whodunit. Right.
Yes.
It's a horror franchise, but it's really a murder mystery. And it's really a sort of, you know, self-aware parlor murder mystery. And all the characters are like, well, one of us has to have done it. You know, there's a joy to that. And somehow this movie just sucks all the joy out of that. All of the relationships are barely serviced. Like there is, as you said, Devendra, there is sort of this like half-assed attempt to create some sort of dynamic between Neve Campbell and her daughter character.
I mean, that is ostensibly, that is the take that this film has, is it's supposed to be, I think, about what is it like to be the daughter of Sidney Prescott? Now, whether or not that succeeded, I think is an open question, but like,
I think it's a closed question. It does not succeed. In my opinion.
Yeah.
It does not succeed. It doesn't, there's no payoff to that. There's no, it is really so just, if you had to write like what in an abstract way, what is a Scream movie? It does all of the things. But there's no juice to it. There's no fun. There's no spark to any moment. It really just feels like it's sleepwalking through all of the minimum requirements for Scream franchise film. There's no creative spark anywhere in this movie. And you feel it. It's not, like Devendra said, it's not bad enough to be entertaining. It's just dull. And that's the true crime here.
You don't want a dull knife. Doesn't stab.
You don't want a dull stab. That's the worst kind of stab.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've been reflecting a lot on the history of the franchise, and I think that the filmmakers behind the franchise were handed an unexpected gift with Scream 6. Mm-hmm. Because what happened in Scream 6, if you recall, is Neve Campbell declined to return, which apparently, as you've indicated, Jeff, was an unforgivable sin in the eyes of Kevin Williamson.
Yeah.
But Neve Campbell declined to return because of a pay dispute. And so the filmmakers were forced to make things work with the new crew that they had. That was an unexpected blessing. First of all, you have two actors, Melissa Barrera and Jenna Ortega, who are not only very talented, but up and coming in their careers. And so it's like, oh, wow, we get to kind of recapture that magic that we recaptured with Scream 1, where like you have all these sort of young actors who are about to become huge, but they're all in this film. and you get to kind of like experience them at the beginning of their careers. So there's that, but also not just like, hey, we have cool new talent. We get to finally say goodbye to Sidney Prescott. And what I mean by that is we had already seen that character's journey over the course of five films, and there is nothing new to say about that character. And this film, Scream 7, definitively proves that that is the case, right? Like, we have attacked the Sidney Prescott sort of idea and theme from every single possible angle.
She has a new brother, right? Yeah, secret brother.
She has a secret mom who's doing stuff that's bad. And, you know, she doesn't know any. Like, we've done everything. Yeah. Yeah. And so it was actually good that the franchise moved on from Sidney Prescott. Melissa Barrera made a bunch of posts in solidarity with Palestine and other things of that nature. I think that history will be kind to the post that Melissa Barrera made in general.
Yep.
Not everything necessarily, but in general. And as a result, she was removed from the franchise. Jenna Ortega left, Christopher Landon, the director, left. And then the filmmakers were scrambling. They were like kind of in a corner. They had to like and then Neve Campbell comes back in, despite not really having worked very much over the course of the last 5 years. She now has a lot of leverage, right? She can be like, hey, you guys need help, and I can give it, and I'm going to ask for a lot of money. And she did. She apparently was paid $7 million for this film, which is very good. But the problem with that is the movie's about Sidney Prescott again. And I thought we'd already left that behind. And so not only was it arguably wrong to eject them for, eject Melissa Barrera for her post, but also artistically, it was the wrong decision to get rid of them for this franchise. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is a real shame, because what has ended up happening is a movie that is completely devoid of any new ideas whatsoever. I think that even at their worst, the Scream films tried to be about something. Like, hey, this is remember there was that Scream film that was like, this is a commentary about fandom. Fans can't be toxic. You know, it's like, oh, that I love. Yeah. Like, it's so pointed against, like, you know, internet fandom and so forth. And I love that. And
they've always been about horror movies in some way.
About horror movies, you know, about horror movie culture, about horror movie fandom. Right? It's always like has some kind of take on that. And this is a movie that not only doesn't have a take on that, in my opinion, it doesn't even seem to try to have a take on that. Like, it doesn't seem make an effort at doing that at all. It is an extremely straightforward slasher film, which is like, okay, even that is not the worst thing, but apparently zero thought has been put into the whodunit stuff. The way that AI is deployed in this film and in conjunction with how the movie is marketed and who's in the film is shameful, I would say.
It's a blunder. It's like already feels outdated.
Jeff is struggling to come up with words to describe how bad this is. I mean, like, it is.
It's like you say AI deployed. It's not that AI was used in the making of the movie. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about like a plot point
that involves like AI. That maybe there are AI deepfakes in the movie. That is a plot
point
in the film. It's
just so clumsy and dumb on the face of it. It reminds me of movies in the 80s or early 90s, you know, that would clumsily attempt to incorporate the latest technology as a plot point, and just anybody that's familiar with the technology would just be groaning. You know, that's kind of how it feels. Like in 2 years, this movie is going to seem so stupidly outdated, in the same way that The Net or, you know, whatever, these old movies from the 90s where it's like, we know about things.
Doesn't have anything to say that's interesting about AI, which was a potential opportunity. It's like, oh, maybe this is the direction the movie's going to go in. Nope, nothing of value to say there. And then, as Jeff has indicated, I would say that at the end of every Scream movie, it is revealed who the killer is, right? Like, that is what happens every Scream movie has a similar structure. The reveal at the end of this film, which we will not say who it is before spoilers, I would describe it as insulting. I would describe it as
fart.
I would describe it as your time as a viewer was not respected, is how I'd describe it. And so at the end of the day, what is sad to me, I mean, this is the most financially successful opening weekend of any Scream film in the entire franchise, right? So like, it did extremely well at the box office. However, because it is so bad, I have a feeling the next one is not going to do as well. You know, that's generally how these things go.
It's sending the wrong signal to the makers of these movies because it's riding the wave of six, which was actually pretty fun. Mm-hmm. And the only, you know, I agree with everything you said in setup, Dave. I just, in addition to the fact that it was a step backwards for the franchise that seemed to be moving forward.
Yes.
Which I do not disagree with at all. I think there is a world where you could make another Sidney Prescott Scream interesting.
Sure.
This movie just did not try.
She could have been interesting in Scream 6 is the thing. I don't think Nev Campbell not being in Scream 6 was a gift because that was, again, the studio being shitty and being like not paying her what she was worth.
Well, it certainly was not an intentional gift. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's like sometimes we hear many times in history about filmmakers forced into a challenging situation, right? And they have to make lemonade out of a challenging situation. And I think they're like, oh, wow, that they did a very reasonably good job with Scream 6, in my opinion, given no Nev Campbell. But it's also an opportunity to like, hey, let's carry on the franchise like in a different direction. I don't know if you guys heard, we can talk maybe in spoilers, but like about some of the plans that they had originally had for the Melissa Barrera character were like pretty interesting in my opinion. And it's really a bummer that they didn't come to pass. But anyway, so Jeff, I agree. It's possible. I think that if this movie had done a better job developing the relationship between Sidney Prescott and her daughter and also done a better job of, well, I mean, first of all, here's the problem, I think, Jeff. Is this movie, Sidney Prescott is still the main character. Like, I think this movie, the daughter needed to be the main character.
They were kind of really setting work. It up to be the daughter and just feels like kinda, it never
but
quite
the,
did
but
that.
Then it's like the movie franchise is just addicted to Sidney Prescott. They like have
what
to
if
go
Sidney
back
Prescott
to Sidney
Prescott was attacked.
Yeah.
The daughter had to figure out who did it.
Right.
I mean, what it's I just, liked about it is that Sidney Prescott is you know Linda Hamilton in T2. Mm-hmm. And I like that. I think there's fun to be, it's hard to identify the problem with this movie because there's just very little right about it.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so, it has, like you guys have laid out so well, it is devoid of any take. It's devoid of any purpose. It's devoid of any ideas, right? Like that's the thing that's so great about Scream is that it has an idea. It is playing with your expectations about how slasher movies work.
And also the characters have seen slasher movies before, which is like generally not a thing in horror films, right? Like people in vampire movies don't know what vampires are very often, right? And so it's like that's cool. It's meta, right?
And there is a scene in this movie where the one character does the thing where she walks around and tells everybody their role in the slasher movie. But in this movie, it's just like
It doesn't work.
It doesn't make sense. It's like all of this movie just feels like it is sleepwalking through the beats that it's supposed to do. It doesn't add anything.
Yeah.
I mean, it feels like it was essentially also a rush script job too, right? Like they had to rewrite whatever this movie
they had
was
to retool the whole
thing
into
this.
So, do we think this is the worst Scream film, guys?
Yes.
I think it's the worst Scream film.
I don't have much love for Scream 3, but you know
Scream,
what?
Scream 3 would be the second worst Scream film, but like this is worse than Scream 3, I think. So, All right, folks, lots more to discuss and spoilers. Let's get to it right now. Spoilers for Scream 7 starting right now.
I thought up an ending for my book.
It makes no damn sense.
Compels me, though.
I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end.
When I buy a new book, I always read the last page first. That way, in case I die before I finish, I know how it ends.
You can't handle the truth!
Inconceivable!
I came here to tell you how it's going to begin.
All right, spoilers for Scream 7 starting right now. I will tell you guys, there was one scene in this movie that I kind of liked, which is when Sidney Prescott and her daughter go into their panic room, And first of all, I wanted to know more about that panic room. I'm like, yeah, should I get one of those put in my house? Like,
of course, but
cool.
Of course, she has a panic room. That feels right.
Character. That makes total sense. Yeah. Makes total sense.
Yeah,
and then she does the thing where she sleeps out the wall, and then Ghostface is stabbing. It's very reminiscent from a scene from Gareth Evans' The Raid.
The Raid, yeah,
which has a very similar sequence.
I would say directly lifted from The Raid.
It
is that scene. It's just that scene.
If you have a panic room that leads directly to a gap in the wall, that's a poorly made panic room. I think you should call the subcontractor and be like, what the fuck is wrong with my panic room?
To be fair, I think she opened some kind of metal door to get there. It wasn't straight. Bad design.
There should be like metal on that wall for sure to block any potential. Sidney Prescott should think about this.
Panic room.
What does the guy do? He stabs. Is he going to stab the wall? Maybe. Maybe. Yeah.
I think there's nothing wrong with the panic room design.
One job, Dave.
She left the panic room.
You should stay in the panic room.
She opened the door and left the panic room.
Panic room is not supposed to have terrifying gap exit. That's not how panic room is supposed to work.
Panic room, they're not out there leaving the panic room.
If there's other exits in the panic room. That's all I'm
there
saying.
There should never be other exits to the panic room.
Because that's a way in.
That's a fault of the panic room. Those are weak points of a panic room.
I like in this movie, by the way, the cops never do anything, even though she is married to a cop.
I know. Like, what's Joel McHale doing in this movie?
It's Joel McHale. I didn't even realize he was in this movie, but that felt like, oh, buddy.
What is he doing in this movie,
aren't you? You're so desperate. Yeah.
All right, guys, we have to talk about the ending. I just want to clarify what I was saying about AI, which is I think it is an incredibly cynical move to advertise this movie as containing Matthew Lillard and David Arquette and all these people. And the way in which they appear is just, if you're looking for those characters, so profoundly unsatisfying the way in which those characters appear in this movie. Right? Like, it's like, how dare you? You know, how dare you? But also, we have to talk about the very ending of the movie, which is like, this is the worst Ghostface killer that there's ever been, right? Like,
because you could have called it a mile away, because you called it as soon as that creepy ass character appeared in the movie.
Well,
like,
yes,
but this guy's too creepy. What's
the next door neighbor is not a character in the movie.
That's the next door neighbor. Yeah,
she's not a character in the movie.
I'm talking about the guy from the mental hospital.
Yeah, the guy is obviously him.
He was obviously part of it.
Yeah,
the woman. You're right. The woman like is barely a character in the movie. But what it doesn't make sense because like her son dies. It's part of all.
Oh, well, she explains that.
Fuck him.
She explains that. She says, hey,
he's like his dad.
He's too much like his dad.
As we know, is what every woman feels about a son once she's divorced the dad.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that you, as a mother, you always turn on your kids once you've soured on the husband. Everybody knows that. That's a tale as old as time.
You definitely are going to put that son's head through a extremely sharp, pointy beer dispensing thingy, right? Like, unclear. Like, you know what's also weird about these things is like, was that her doing that or was that the dude?
It's got to be the dude. It's got to be the dude doing it. But
why would you design it like that?
The idea that we could imagine it was her doing it and that she would dress up to murder her own son is so patently, and that the explanation we give is, I didn't really like him anyway.
Didn't like
what? Yeah.
But also, it was pretty obvious because when they punched in the security code for their little cafe, it was like, oh, it's the only other person who knows that security code, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like,
this movie's so bold.
The fact that she has maybe three lines tops before the big reveal that it was her.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, there is no setup for that woman in the movie at all.
Yeah. And well, that's one scene where she's like the friend, basically. Yeah.
Go ahead, Jeff. Go ahead. Finish what you're saying.
Her son has more, we know more about him.
Yeah.
It makes no, it like you said, Dave, it is insultingly bad. Like, there is something kind of cool about, but like every single thing in this movie is clumsy. We know it can't be Matthew Lillard, Stu Mocker. because that's not how these movies work.
Well, first of all, I'm actually really glad it wasn't Stu Marker, because that would have been really bad. Like, I would have been really upset at that.
But but it's important in the structure of how this movie is set up that we think it could have been. Like, that we are led to, but like, the only way a swerve works is if it is possible that it is him.
Yes.
And it is never possible that it is him, because we know how these movies work. And in the Scream franchise, when it's working well, you have a character that says that we know how these movies work, so it can't be him. Like, that could have been the fun of it.
Why do you?
But
think
it's never the fun of it.
Why do you? You lost me a little bit, Jeff. Why do you think it couldn't have been him because of how these movies work? That part I don't. I
because
think
these movies, there is a reveal of who it is. So the person that's going, "It's me. I'm the one."
I see.
Isn't
I see.
It? Right?
I see. Yeah.
Like the movie, we have this kind of fun thing, which I don't know. You guys can correct me. I don't know if it's ever happened in a Scream movie where they kill Ghostface in like the first quarter of the movie and we pull his mask off and they're like, "What? That's not even a guy we know." And I was like, "Oh, that's fun. That's a fun idea." But like, again, nothing is done with that. Nothing is, you know, there's no build on that. And then the rest of the movie is just like, "Hey, it's Stu Marker over a phone," which is creates zero tension. It's literally just like, "Look at the actor that we got." And then we have that weird montage of like all the other actors that we could, that we had record something on their phone for us that one day. But like there could have been a joy in sending up the legacy sequel of it all, the bringing back the impossible characters, but the movie is just too lazy to even attempt something clever about it. It's just going through the motions.
We could right now, sitting here, write better ideas for Scream movies. You want a Scream AI movie? Okay, AI trained on the history of the Scream story, the Stab universe, starts building its own Scream story. The AI is ultimately the killer or something. Like, powers a robot that is a killer. They even have a robot Scream mask at some point. So,
which is, again, another dumb idea that for no reason at all, but whatever. Yeah.
I hate this movie.
It's really bad. Again, it's not bad enough to be fun. It's just lazy. It's lazy.
The one that's really hard to believe. So the idea is that we are meant to understand that this guy, this mental institution guy, he used to work at Google, so he got really good at deepfakes.
Yeah.
And then he made a deepfake of everyone that's ever been involved in any Scream film, including, by the way, Laurie Metcalf from Scream 2, which is like,
good
how would he even know what her deal is? It doesn't make any sense.
That would have been in the news.
But like, there's not necessarily like a lot of footage of her, because she, anyway. Okay. Point being, he was able to create an aged version of Laurie Metcalf and Stu Marker. Yeah.
Why is it aged?
Matthew Lillard and all the people who coincidentally look like how they would look today. Exactly. even Dewey, who is dead in the world of the film, they like just aged him up a little bit.
Yes, he creates a version of them. Like, he adds the scarring
the crow's feet and all that stuff, right? Like,
the attention to detail.
That's called
meticulous.
This guy's just an artist, really.
He used to work at Google, okay?
Yeah.
And the idea is that this other woman, who's played by Anna Kemp, is institutionalized because she used to idolize Sidney Prescott, but got so mad that Sidney Prescott wasn't in Scream 6 that she's like, "How dare you? I'm going to go insane and start killing people as a result of it." That is
feel
another
that
statement on fan
husband.
Culture.
Her abusive husband made that happen too.
Okay, I guess, right? Like, I know that's why she started. Well, anyway, by the way, I think this is one of the films that has the least connection between the first, like the opening scene, and the rest of the film.
Yeah.
Right. Like.
Yep.
Yeah. Like,
makes no sense. Who are those people? Who cares?
Ghostface offers some perfunctory explanation for why they did it, but like it doesn't really, like, whereas in many of the other Scream films, it's like at least tied in directly with the main plot of the film. So really the things that I think are the biggest pleasures one has for screen films, like the opening kill, how it ties into the rest, the whodunit component, the reveal at the end. None of these things are done well in this film. That is the problem.
But at the end of the day, everybody got paid. That's all that matters.
Also,
Dude, I didn't even bring this up. The way that Gale Weathers is reintroduced.
Yeah.
That almost killed the film for me right there. Right? The idea is that Sidney Prescott is being attacked by a killer, and then literally right at the last minute, Gale Weathers and crew shows up and smashes that guy in. Wow. Really lucky coincidence there. Like
that's what ruined it for you. What ruined it for me is the freaking interview, which is just like Gale betraying Sidney again. We've done so many movies.
Well,
about
and it's a complete reboot on Gale Weathers. It's like, remember all that stuff she did? Wow, none of that worked out. So she's got to be the character from the first movie again.
Well, and then Sidney at the end saying that their relationship is complex but enduring. I'm like, it from my recollection, most of it has been bad. Like, why is there any affection for these two people? Anyway, I just
they also the what a disaster. Sidney Prescott's daughter has a boyfriend who literally she catches making the deep fake that we know to be the killer's deep fake. Like,
but he was just
make,
testing it. No, that was just testing it. That was a deep fake head fake, Jeff. That was a red herring.
I understand that. Yeah. I'm well aware. But she forgives him with no new information. When she sees him again,
because
the last time she saw him, she hits him in the face because he was doing exactly what the killer would have done. And then the next time she sees them, she's sorry.
But there's a ghost face right there, though, Jeff. So in her mind, she's like, oh, he's not Ghostface.
Yeah,
now, she might not
because
think
we know
head,
from the screen movies there can be only one because we already killed one.
Yeah, but there's always freaking two Ghostface, though, generally. At least two, right? So
it makes no sense that she forgives him with
well,
no
she, again, she leaves the boyfriend and then Ghostface is right outside. Like, Jeff, the normal human brain is going to conclude, so he's not Ghostface. You know, like,
Sure.
Now, that would have been a very wrong. You and I know that that's a bad conclusion.
I think anybody. Yeah. I still saw you making the thing the killer made.
Like, why? Speaking of artists, Jeff, I mean, you know, Jeff, you often talk about how underappreciated the art of acting is. Sidney Prescott's daughter's boyfriend really committed to the part of the deepfake, right? Like he's like, I'm gonna fucking kill you, Sidney Prescott. Like you saw him acting in the little video.
What should I do? Oh man, I gotta see if this if a deepfake would work. I gotta do it exactly the same.
I gotta threaten to kill my girlfriend's mom, even in jest. Surely there's no way this could be misinterpreted.
I also love you guys. I mean, I know. Devendra works at Engadget. He understands exactly how deepfakes work, is that it takes the image and then it goes, and then it creates the deepfake. You guys saw that moment where it just like morphed the face. It was like, and then it created the deepfake out of that.
That's totally how it works.
That was my
favorite part. I will tell you, there's one moment where I was like, is this movie going to surprise me? Is when they killed the daughter stand-in. Like eviscerated that poor girl while she was hanging up on the stage. It was like, are they going to introduce a character, set her up, and then kill her 10 minutes later?
Within 5 to 10 minutes. Yeah, that was kind of like,
That could have been something, although Sidney does not deserve more pain and torture in her life. And I was like, of course, false. Never, like, will never actually happen.
Again, the movie is so up Sidney Prescott's anus that, you know, you could have had the next door neighbor has a child who's in the high school with Sydney's daughter, and she has got some beef about that and starts murdering high school kids. And then Sydney has to come out of retirement and deal with that. And it could have been all about the high school. And Sydney thinks it's my daughter that they're after because it's me and it's Ghostface. And no, it was just a PTA mom who was pissed at something. Like, Any take.
In my opinion, they should have made the daughter the main character. They cannot get away from Sidney Prescott. And that is the original sin of this franchise. And also, people love it because it made over $60 million this weekend. So, you know.
I think the next Scream movie should be? I think it would be really fun because one of the things I love about the Scream franchise is that in the context of the Scream franchise, there is Scream movies, right? The Stab franchise exists inside the Scream franchise. I think it would be funny if they had so many of these movies have been about copycat killers who just want to recapture the original glory, right? It would be so wonderful if the next movie was about a copycat killer that liked the movies more than the real story and started going after the actors in the movies instead of the real Sidney Prescott. And so you had this weird
You're describing the Scream 3 plot, Jeff.
That's not really what happened.
It's close to it.
It's close.
He starts killing the actors in the Stab movie in the order in which they're killed in the film. Or, I guess that's true. Yeah, so
how brilliant those early movies were. You're reinventing them now.
I'm a little disappointed that there was not more Stab in this movie. You know, like
I agree.
More Stab would have been
the beginning of the movie makes you think that there's going to be a lot of movie stuff, and there's no movie stuff.
Oh man, I will say I'm done with this franchise. I'm done with this franchise right now. Unless studio makes good with Radio Silence or something, they've got nothing. They have completely failed this franchise. They failed the fans of this franchise. Like screwed all of this. If we could have backed out from this movie, knowing how bad it would have been, I don't know. I would have been all for it.
There's 100% going to be a Scream 8, though.
Yeah, I mean, there absolutely will be.
I'm just I don't care.
Well, that'll be a problem for future us to discuss.
Yeah, that's until, a future us problem. We have a couple of wars to get through, and then we'll see. Then we'll see Scream 8.
Until then, at the end of the day, despite every single thing we have said during the course of the last 37 minutes, it is really impressive that Kevin Williamson made a movie.
Maybe it's not. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes, no.
I just watched that Megadoc. You know, that Megadoc, and it's like, hey, you know, even Megalopolis, one of the most catastrophic movies, a lot of work went into it.
Of energy went into that movie. It took decades of creative energy. What does this movie have to show for it?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, it is still impressive that Kevin Williamson made a movie, in my opinion.
I don't know.
All right, folks, that's going to bring us to the end of this episode of the podcast. Our music comes from Tim McEwen from The Midnight. He wrote our theme song. Check out their new album, Syndicate. Our spoiler bumper and weekly plugs music comes from Noah Ross, who also edited this episode, with video assistance provided by Kurt Mega and John Barry. Next week on the podcast, we're going to be discussing the new movie, The Bride, or as I believe it's called, The Bride!
The Bride!
The Bride!
Look, over there!
Because it has an exclamation mark after it. So
yeah.
It's The Bride! The Bride! Next week on the podcast. They are Davinder Hall and Jeff Gennett. I'm David Chen. We'll see you later. Bye.